from WNYC in New York. This is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. This week, as the global media fixated on Russia's military takeover of Crimea, two American journalists for the Kremlin-funded news channel Russia Today launched themselves into the story. On Wednesday, RT anchor Liz Wall announced her resignation live on air.
Personally, I cannot be part of a network funded by the Russian government that whitewashes the actions of Putin. I'm proud to be an American and believe in disseminating the truth. And that is why, after this newscast, I'm resigning.
Her departure followed the sensation triggered by another RT host, Abby Martin, who ended her daily program, Breaking the Set, on Monday with an off-script denunciation of Russia's intervention in Ukraine.
Just because I work here for RT doesn't mean I don't have editorial independence. And I can't stress enough how strongly I am against any state intervention in a sovereign nation's affairs. What Russia did is wrong. I admittedly don't know as much as I should about Ukraine's history or the cultural dynamics of the region, but what I do know is that military intervention is never the answer. And I will not sit here and apologize or defend military aggression. Furthermore, the coverage I've seen of Ukraine has been truly disappointing from all sides of the media spectrum and rife with disinformation.
Given that RT is widely regarded as a 24-hour propaganda machine engineered to polish Russia's image abroad, Abby Martin shocked many with her outburst. However, the firebrand media critic who caught RT's eye while an Occupy activist and a 9/11 truther says she wasn't afraid to speak out despite RT's pro-Russian slant.
I knew that there would come a day when I wouldn't agree with what Russia was doing, and I knew that I would have to speak out when that day came and risk my job. And that day came on Monday, and it was really, really incredible to see everything that happened in the aftermath and just be able to keep my job and have my network recognize that it's good to have dissent, and I will continue to speak out against what I think is wrong.
The response by your RT management has been kind of all over the place. Mm-hmm. First, they said it proves their editorial independence. Mm-hmm. Then that you've been somehow brainwashed by Western media coverage. But then they said they're going to dispatch you to Crimea, I guess, for firsthand reporting on the subject. But it sounded kind of punitive in a sort of Russian frontish way.
That was a strange one. I woke up to kind of this statement that was already circulating saying I was being shipped to Crimea. And I said, that's funny. I haven't been asked. So I go into the network and you know, they kindly asked me. They said, we'd love to send you there today. And I just said, look, I would never go unless I could have the time to make my own contacts in Kiev on the ground, get proper training that I would reconsider in the future if I could do my independent research and have an independent trip other than taking the chance of having a vetted experience. Not that they said that it would be. I didn't want to take that chance.
Hmm. Now, from here, your denunciation of the Kremlin's policy had a sort of shock, there's gambling going on in this establishment vibe to it. I mean, you do, after all, work for a Kremlin-funded channel that puts a Putin-friendly gloss on almost everything it reports.
I mean, you're working on a network that accepts money from oil companies. I mean, and you guys omit information about different things happening in the Gulf of Mexico oil spills. I think all of us in the media understand that the payment comes from somewhere and there's a lot of self-censorship going on. But like I said, I knew that there would be a time where I couldn't not speak out against Putin and against Russia, and I would risk losing my job. In fact, people have on the establishment media. They've gotten fired for it. And RT gives me a lot of freedom.
Just for the record, I'll say there's no self-censorship going on this end of the microphone. But before this episode, Abby, you were like nobody's idea of a wallflower. You've railed against both U.S. policy and U.S. media. I understand in your promos for the media criticism show you host, you smash a television with a sledgehammer?
Indeed. I think what the U.S. was doing in Ukraine, meddling and helping kind of fund the opposition movement, was wrong, and I called it out. And the second that I saw Russia advance with its military, I said, you know what? This is wrong.
After your denunciation of Putin's actions in Crimea, your colleague Liz Wall resigned live on the air, calling RT's coverage of Ukraine a whitewash. What was the reaction among your colleagues?
I can only speak for myself because she kind of left right after that happened. But all my colleagues were really proud of me. Everyone really supported what I did. And I work with pretty much all just really passionate American journalists who work at this network so we can speak out against different things that other corporate entities can't speak out against that are beholden to their advertisers or hurt the establishment line.
I certainly get that you believe a big swath of Western media is sort of corporate-funded propaganda, including NPR. But has this episode made you think about the wisdom or practicality of fighting one kind of propaganda with explicit propaganda from the Kremlin?
Come on, man. That's such a cheap shot. You guys are doing the same thing as well as every other person working in a media outlet that is funded by questionable entities. I mean, come on. I have total journalistic integrity and editorial freedom to say what I want to say. So are you saying that I shouldn't have the platform to do that just because the Kremlin or whatever you're saying, even though it's grants in Russia, just like BBC and Al Jazeera? I mean, if I can't speak out about those things, then of course I wouldn't work here. And if I got fired, then that would be a bigger story. You have to ask the question, why do I have to work for RT to tell the truth about the U.S. establishment and what's really happening, and to try to hold corporations accountable for their actions?
Are you going to keep your job?
I don't know.
We know about the aborted attempt to send you to Crimea, but what have your bosses said to you?
My boss just said, I support your decision to speak out. We value your show, and we value your integrity.
Has anything taken place in the aftermath of your on-air statement that particularly surprised or amused or horrified you?
I think the most amusing thing is how it got viral just because it fit this insane Cold War resurrection going on all across the establishment press, trying to just demonize everything about Russia right now. They latched onto it, and then when they realized my politics were too radical to fit into their paradigm, they just smeared me.
Smeared how?
Oh, just dredging up everything that I've ever done in the last 10 years, totally misquoting me, mischaracterizing who I am, just to try to tear me down and say, this is all staged. I mean, it's just absurd, the levels that people would go to try to minimize risking a job on a network paid by the Kremlin to speak out against Russia. And that's really the bottom line of the story. And unfortunately, a lot of people, you know, took off with it and tried to make their own stories out of it.
Abby, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Abby Martin is host of Breaking the Set on Russia Today. But what exactly is Russia Today? If a journalist criticizing the government is a shock, how much journalism is happening there in the first place, as opposed to PR? Newsweek's Matthew Cooper wrote that when it comes to Ukraine, RT is like going to a Cold War theme park, only without the breadlines. At the National Journal, Lucia Graves wrote that, according to RT, the crisis in Crimea is an adventure filled with, quote, tea, sandwiches, and selfies. BuzzFeed's list of the most insane moments from RT's coverage included this accusation of American hypocrisy.
Double standards galore. Washington suffers sleepless nights and paranoia when it comes to the nuclear capabilities of countries like Iran.
Iran's nuclear program.
Iran's nuclear program.
Iran's nuclear program.
But the U.S. turns a blind eye when it comes to provocative statements coming out of Kiev.
Because Ukraine is such a threat to neighboring... Wait, what? According to Julia Yaffe, senior editor at The New Republic, RT's coverage is perfectly balanced between promoting Vladimir Putin and ridiculing the West.
They love running stories about American homelessness, the American government and the British government spying on their own citizens, as if the rest of the media is not reporting critically on this. They ignore the things that are not convenient. So, for example, Russia Today was all over covering anti-war protests in the U.S. and in the West this summer when there was a threat of Western military intervention in Syria, to show that Western governments kind of drag their own people kicking and screaming into war because, you know, that's what the corrupt West does. However, there were anti-war protests in Moscow and St. Petersburg when Putin asked for the authorization of the use of force in Ukraine. Those protests were brutally broken up by police. Hundreds of people were arrested. Was there a single mention of that on Russia Today? The answer is no.
Is there any real news that kind of launders the propaganda that's at the heart of the channel?
Well, they're able to get access to people that other media doesn't. So they were one of the first, for example, to broadcast a long interview with Bashar al-Assad. you know, obviously drawing on their sponsors' close ties to him. And I find myself, for example, retweeting some of their breaking news. But often I find their coverage quite comical. It's like watching Colbert without the irony. No, I'm serious. They had, for example, when Julian Assange, who is quite a complicated figure, when he was trying to be extradited to Sweden to face charges of sexual abuse, Russia Today did a long expose about how Sweden had actually become a colony of the U.S., and they had some strange professor in Coke bottle glasses talking about how they were showing reruns of Deer Hunter on Swedish TV, and this was proof. And they called it the United States of Sweet America.
You did a piece where you interviewed staffers at Russia Today, and they said, yeah, we understand it's not exactly a news organization, but the checks don't bounce. Surely they understand what the role of this organization is. How do they go to work in the morning?
They started hiring during a really intense media crisis in the West, and people were coming out of journalism schools with very dim job prospects, and here comes Russia Today offering really fat paychecks and a really cool experience. You know, go live in Russia of all places, and you get to be on TV. The problem is that these people in Moscow, as I saw it, led pretty sheltered lives and didn't really understand the country around them very well. The Russians who work there, you know, there's fewer and fewer jobs to go around there too, and that's because the Kremlin is cracking down on independent media and forcing outlets to close or having them taken over by Kremlin-friendly oligarchs. So you kind of start to do the things that people did in the Soviet Union, where you try to walk a really fine line and you work for this organization, but you try not to do the really odious stories. You try to do things like, oh, I just focus on culture and theater, and so what I do is okay.
On the subject of crossing that line, earlier in the week, one of RT's hosts, Abby Martin, in the middle of her broadcast, took the opportunity to condemn the invasion in Crimea, declaring that she has the journalistic independence to say so.
They said, oh, look, we really have freedom of speech, but most people haven't read the Russian response of Margarita Simonyan, who's the editor-in-chief of this channel and is just a vicious attack dog in defense of Kremlin policies. She wrote that this is how good the Western propaganda machine is, that they've managed to sully the mind of even the most ardent Russia Today employees, and we need to work that much harder to defeat the Western propaganda machine. When your editor-in-chief talks like that, you're not a news organization. You're a propaganda machine yourself.
Can Russians see RT?
They can online, but it's for the West, and now they also have a Spanish language channel and an Arabic language channel. I don't know where Americans, frankly, can see RT outside of hotel rooms.
Makes me wonder whether we are getting our skivvies in a wad over essentially nothing, right? If propaganda falls on the forest and everybody is watching the game show network, does it really matter?
I think it does matter because RT, especially as it expands its U.S. bureaus in New York and Washington, has been trying for years to show itself as a serious news gathering organization and trying to get more people to watch them. And it's fine to watch them. You just should know what you're watching, that this isn't analogous to, say, CNN or even to MSNBC or Fox.
The United States has Voice of America. It has a 24-hour news channel called Al Hurra. We're not shy ourselves about putting across the U.S. point of view. Is there a difference between our version of propaganda and Russia's?
Voice of America doesn't try to present itself as a news organization, as a straight-up news organization. Then people know what it is. Russia Today is trying to fly under the radar and kind of have it both ways. The problem is that this is also a classic Russian tactic. They love to spend money on changing their image rather than to focus their efforts on changing the things that drive the perception, the actions, the corruption, things like that. This reminds me of this Russian blogger, a photographer who does a news photo blog. And one day he was photographing a bunch of paratroopers celebrating Paratrooper Day in Russia and frolicking in the fountains in their underwear. kissing each other and just being drunk and almost naked in public. It happens once a year in Russia. He was approached by a cop, and the cop said, "Why are you making Russia look bad?" So it's not the guys frolicking in the fountain and just being obliterated in public. It's the photographer getting those images out that makes Russia look bad. And this is very much the logic in which Russia Today was created and operates.
Julia, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Julia Yaffe is a senior editor at The New Republic. Coming up in Serbia, journalists do the unthinkable and join forces with the police to solve the murder of one of their own.
Just us all being in the same room, brainstorming, I think was critical to new information being dug up.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Over the weekend, about 30 men in unmarked fatigues and balaclavas broke into the office of the Crimean Center for Investigative Journalism, an independent news media hub in Simferopol, the region's capital. Declaring the office a source of lies, they removed computers and files. This, the latest instance of escalating aggression towards journalists in Crimea and the rest of Ukraine. Among those alarmed by the escalating intimidation is Dunya Mijatovic, representative on Freedom of the Media for the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE. A native Bosnian, Mijatovic is all too familiar with the scenario, having witnessed such thuggery firsthand 20 years ago amid the siege of Sarajevo. She described reaching Simferopol and feeling deja vu.
The moment you land, you feel the tension. The situation is very similar when it comes to the atmosphere of fear and also having a constant question mark in which direction Crimea will go. So maybe I'm doing this job in order to find out how it is possible to make people speak their mind without being intimidated and harassed constantly for just reporting on what's happening in their society.
In the matter of free press, there is one advantage, I guess, in Crimea that was not available to the journalists in Sarajevo 20 years ago. They can shut down the presses and they can remove the computers, but they can't turn off the internet.
Yeah, that's a good one. I think we are in a bit better position. At least there is a possibility to send information even quicker, and there is a possibility for more voices.
If in your investigations you discover that this intimidation does have Russian fingerprints, that the troops who took over the press center were Russian soldiers, is there anything that the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe can actually do besides raise its voice?
Well, I mean, there are many mechanisms that the OSCE has, and this is currently discussed in Vienna during a permanent council that is meeting on a daily basis, and there was some news coming out when it comes to general political situation. My mandate is very focused, and it's related to media, because, you know, you cannot talk about any security if there is no free media. You cannot talk about respect for human rights if there is no free media to report it. So for me, as an official of the OSCE, I'm also giving this message to all 57 participating states: do not talk to me about security if you do not let media speak freely.
You're very kind to join us. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Dunja Mijatovic is representative on Freedom of the Media for the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. She spoke to us from Kiev. 30 goons break into your office and confiscate your computers, your hard drives, your files, and with them a big chunk of your institutional memory. Who are you going to call? Well, in this case, the Global Investigative Journalism Network, an NGO of which the Crimean Center for Investigative Journalism is a member. The organization worked swiftly and secretly with the San Francisco-based Internet Archive to restore the Crimean Center's entire web history. One of the coordinators of this effort is David E. Kaplan, the executive director of the Global Investigative Journalism Network.
The day after it happened, I'm riding in an elevator with a very friendly guy. We introduce each other, and he says he's from the Internet Archive. Do you know what that is? Well, any good investigative journalist knows about the Wayback Machine.
This is Brewster Kahle's vision of essentially backing up the entire Internet.
They've backed up the web. Yes, it's just terrific. But there are a lot of holes in it, particularly outside the U.S. And this Ukrainian site, the Crimean Center for Investigative Journalism, had not been backed up except in the sparest of ways. And I said, can you guys back up the Crimean Center? They have the best people in the world to back up an archive site. And they're able to grab not only the text now, but the graphics, the photos, the captions. We now have a complete digital record of what this gutsy frontline Center for Investigative Journalism has done in Crimea. We have digitally archived their entire record of publishing.
The pages that were recovered are in Ukrainian, in Russian, English, what language?
They're mostly in Ukrainian. Most of the staff does not speak English, so we were working through our colleagues in Kiev to figure out what was going on and monitoring what the team in Simferopol was publishing, because they had documented the entire attack. There was video. They took photos. They quoted these guys as they came through the door.
That's pretty crazy. So they were actually interviewing the guys dispatched to oppress them.
Well, they were quoting them. I'm not sure what's an interview situation. If you look on our site, there's one that actually got tweeted around a lot. Quote, we will try to agree on the correct, truthful coverage of events.
Yeah. Was there anything that particularly struck you as being indispensable that you were grateful that you were able to salvage?
These guys have specialized in corruption and national security stories, and these are both cutting-edge issues in Ukraine. I mean, Yanukovych was driven from office in large part because of corruption. The real stories have not come out yet, and I think it's one of the reasons that this Crimean Center was targeted, because they have been digging up dirt on corruption. They've also had a regular TV program on national security, raising uncomfortable issues for the people in power. So it wasn't a mistake that as Russian troops are streaming into Crimea, this place, the adjacent independent press office, and the public TV and radio station were all targeted.
Now, you mentioned that there are 90 other such organizations around the world. Are you going to be proactive with them now to try to do the same thing for them before there's a crisis in play?
It's a great question, and indeed, this is very much on our minds. A lot of our membership, nearly half, are in developing and conflict-ridden countries, and these are journalists who, you know, the freedoms we take for granted of publishing, of access to information, of access to tools and digital media, they have to fight for every day. And it's really on our minds. So we'd like to work with the Internet Archive to get them all backed up and then figure out how to go forward. The great equalizer now, Bob, is all these digital tools that we have. You know, we've lost a lot of investigative reporters and investigative teams around the world. We're able to do so much more with these tools now than we could, you know, even 5 years ago. It's pretty exciting.
Have you been in touch with the folks at the Crimean Center? Are they back up and running?
Strangely, the authorities have not shut down their site. They're still publishing. They just don't have access to their office or much of their equipment anymore. But they're in their homes, and we understand they're all safe. But it's pretty dangerous on the road. Journalists are getting hassled at checkpoints, and there's a sister, Crimean Center, and the director of that has been assaulted and her camera taken. So these are not good times for the media there.
David, thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks for paying attention to this.
David E. Kaplan is the executive director of the Global Investigative Journalism Network. Twitter handle at GIJN. If reporters are threatened in Crimea, it is not exactly an Eastern European first. In Russia, 17 journalists, among them Anna Politkovskaya, have been killed since the year 2000. And in the bloody unraveling of ex-Yugoslavia's Slobodan Milosevic regime, many a score was violently settled with journalists deemed unpatriotic or too nosy about rampant corruption. Only last year, the Serbian government established a commission to investigate unsolved journalist murders. But with this odd wrinkle, the commission includes both the police and journalists, who together have combed through years of evidence. In January, the strange bedfellows achieved a remarkable result, the arrest of two former security officials for the murder of independent journalist Slavka Ćuruvija. Ćuruvija, a vocal opponent of the Milosevic regime, was shot 17 times in the back in 1999. Liljana Smilovic is the editor of Politika, Serbia's most prominent daily. She's also a member of the commission and president of the Serbian Journalists Association, and she worked alongside Ćuruvija at the magazine named The European.
I was foreign editor of his political magazine, and we started out wanting to just do decent journalism, and it wasn't so much that we wanted to do any muckraking or anything, but if you just covered events in a normal way, if, for example, when Serbian forces laid siege to the house of a prominent Albanian guerrilla leader, then when the household resisted and would not surrender, the Serbian forces killed dozens and dozens of members of the family. And the Serbian police put out a statement that 68 terrorists were killed yesterday. We refused to use the police statement, and we refused to call those family members terrorists. This was one of the things that got Ćuruvija in trouble with the Milosevic regime.
Now, I want to get to the investigation itself. As I understand, reporters are working hand in glove with police to conduct this investigation.
Well, the journalist did not do any of the investigation itself, but we sat in the same room and we looked again at all the evidence. And some of us were able to point out holes in the circumstantial evidence that had been gathered by the police. And we were able to tell the police, did you ask this person? Did you know that this person was involved? We called new witnesses to be deposed before the commission. We had people coming to us who had not trusted the state, who had not trusted the police. And they came forward to us and they offered new evidence and it produced new results.
Were the police, who found themselves in very unfamiliar waters, being at such close quarters with journalists, were they comfortable with this whole process?
Not for months. In the beginning, we had some angry and hostile moments. I was afraid personally of being compromised by taking part in this exercise, and the police were very suspicious of us. Once they found out that we were not going around telling tales, and that we were able to keep confidential information, and once they realized that we knew more things than they did, then we gained some degree of cooperation that we had not dreamed would exist. And in the end, just us all being in the same room, brainstorming, I think was critical to new information being dug up.
Reporters often take information off the record and then are obliged to go try to discover it independently in an on-the-record fashion. I'm curious, though, were you privy to bombshells that you were dying to tell your readers but were forbidden to because of your agreement with the police?
Yes, all the time, and I still am. I wish I could shout some things from the rooftops, but I am sure they will have to come out during the trial, and I can live until that moment. I really do not want to undermine the trial in any way. And besides, I have signed an oath that I would not share information that's confidential.
Presented with that document, I'm not sure I could have signed my name.
But it's all going to come out. And for that, it's worth holding your breath a little.
Arrests have been made of the alleged trigger man. But presumably, these murders were ordered by someone in state security, and almost certainly at the behest of either Milosevic or perhaps his wife, Mira Markovic, who was also enormously powerful. Is there a chance that these arrests will lead to someone higher up the chain being held accountable?
We certainly hope so. It's, of course, not enough to find the hitman. The point of this whole exercise is to understand why our lives unfolded the way they did. It is unimaginable that Slavko Churuvia would have been murdered without some complicity, some order being given by Mr. Milosevic and his wife.
Milosevic, of course, is dead. Mira Markovic is living, I believe, in luxurious exile in Russia, assuming she is out of the reach of justice. Tell me about the role of this investigation in the truth and reconciliation in Serbia, a process that has lagged compared to other societies that have grim histories to come to terms with.
We suspect that Churuvia was killed because he was seen as an enemy of the state, as a traitor to his country. Now, I assure you, Mr. Churuvia was no traitor, and he was a patriot, and we were all patriots in that little opposition magazine. And it offends me no end to have people who were willing to kill a journalist consider themselves morally superior to those of us who were fighting Mr. Milosevic's regime for its life. And what we are fighting for here is for everyone to understand, in security forces, in the army, everywhere, and that no one holds the right to such truth to determine who is an enemy of the state. And this is why this has been such a hard case to crack, because the people who were investigating it, many of them, I suspect, found it loathsome to investigate their own colleagues over the fate of someone who had widely, in those services, been considered a traitor to his country.
Liljana, I thank you.
I thank you.
Liljana Smilovic is a member of the commission to investigate the facts related to the murders of journalists. She's editor of Politica and president of the Serbian Journalists Association. A lot of this show has been devoted to freedom of information abroad. Last week, we addressed the issue at home. We focused on the Department of Homeland Security, specifically Customs and Border Patrol, which appears to function without oversight and with near total impunity. We have scattered accounts of shocking civil rights violations at our borders, but we don't have data because DHS won't give it to us, or it seems, to Congress. To find out what's going on, we've created a handy tool that will supply you with sample questions and enable you to easily connect with your congressperson. Don't expect quick answers, but we won't get any if we don't ask. After last week's show, many people tried the tool, but they used it on the weekend when congressional offices are closed. So please try it or try it again during the week. Help us increase the pressure to shed light on DHS. Find the tool at onthemedia.org. Coming up, television beyond your wildest streams. This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. The Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at PewTrust.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives on the web at Hewlett.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
From Hollywood, it's Jimmy Kimmel Live after the Oscars.
If you caught Jimmy Kimmel's post-Oscar special last Sunday night, you got to witness the torch being passed from the good old days to the brave new world. It began unremarkably with a big star and the obligatory clip.
Just a minute, please. He does not deserve
Francis,
a medal. I'm telling you that
I
man deserves to be taken out
I
and shot.
I'm begging you.
No.
Please.
No.
Do
I
not,
said just a minute.
Do not make a scene. Please.
the great Kevin Spacey promoting not a Hollywood movie or even a network TV show, but the pioneering Netflix streaming video series, House of Cards.
That's what a great show. I mean, you play a great villain.
Well, yeah, for those who have a stake in the status quo, broadcast television, for half a century America's dominant cultural force, has lost its primacy. On April 9th, 1979, a single episode of All in the Family entertained more than 40 million Americans. On Wednesday, 35 years later, in a country with a 39% larger population, the first hour of primetime attracted the identical audience for the top five networks combined. The other 277 million Americans were doing something else. Some are on YouTube, watching cats play with parakeets, or perhaps watching internet personality Kingsley inveighing against bad baby names.
If I had been married for 5 years and we were about to finally have our child, and they woke up one morning and looked at me and said, I want to name our baby Bonquisha Charisse, I would be like, what the f***?
And still others might have checked out funnyordie.com to see Will Ferrell shouting at his 2-year-old landlord Pearl for the 81 millionth and first time.
Hi, Pearl.
Where's your rent?
You don't have to raise your voice.
You pay now!
I can give you half.
You pay now, bitch!
Goodbye, broadcast. Hello, broadband. For the past decade, it has been abundantly clear that the digital revolution was nudging the old model toward collapse. But what hasn't been clear is what will emerge from the rubble. Until maybe now.
It is moving at the speed of light.
Professor Jeffrey Cole is director of the Center for the Digital Future at USC's Annenberg School for Communications and Journalism.
Binge viewing on Netflix, original programming on Prime, Chromecast, a $35 dongle that can let you stream content from your phone or your tablet to your television set. I mean, the number of developments in the last year is just astonishing.
And it is by no means just the technology that's changing. The online successors to traditional TV stories are developed differently, promoted differently, monetized differently, and most of all, told differently.
This is Michael Bluth. For 10 years, he's worked for his father's company waiting to be made a partner. And right now, he's happy. This is Michael's mother.
Look what they've done, Michael.
She isn't happy.
Things only become good when they have to.
Mitch Hurwitz is the executive producer of Arrested Development, a groundbreaking comedy that nonetheless struggled on the Fox network. Though it attracted a cult audience delighted with its subversive humor, it never grabbed the lumpen proletariat who seemed to favor the raunchy one-liners on, say, Two and a Half Men. Now, Arrested Development is a Netflix original. To Hurwitz, the structure of serialized streaming TV, often consumed binge style, offers the chance to develop story and character that episodic broadcast TV simply does not.
With a show that streams, you're really trying to set up as a creative person where you're going to be in 15 episodes. You're doing the things that a novelist does. And there's a reason that a short story can grab you more than a novel in the same amount of pages. The novel's building something bigger, perhaps. I think if you look at great shows in the last couple of years, they've had to endure a lot of criticism. Mad Men has really gone downhill. Breaking Bad, what happened to Breaking Bad? This season is awful. They've seen three. Right by the end of that season, they say, oh my God, this was the best thing ever, because they have now taken in the whole experience. That's what streaming allows.
Joe Lewis is head of comedy for Amazon Studios.
When we start a story, we're going to finish it, whether that's 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 seasons. And to me, that's what the new paradigm of TV is about. People will watch in order. And when they watch in an order, that brings a whole other level of drama. It's compelling. It's like real life.
They're in Brave New World Part 2, the unprecedented ability to understand exactly what audiences want. And not mass audiences, but discrete clusters defined by personal tastes. Sure, the old methodology gave us All in the Family and Gunsmoke, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, and Lost. Mainly, though, overwhelmingly, it produced the likes of this.
Porter, that's my mother, dear. She helps me through everything I do, and I'm so glad she's here.
My Mother, the Car, circa 1966, sort of Norman Bates meets Mr. Ed, because if a man talking to his horse is hilarious, wouldn't it be twice as funny? It lasted one season. Amazon's Joe Louis.
In the old days, there'd be most likely one person at a network and a small group of people around them that would watch the shows and, you know, off their best instincts would make a decision on what most of America would watch. We want to transcend that entirely and take people like myself out of the process.
Instead, Amazon Studios puts the audience in the process by sharing scripts and pilot footage on its website drawn from both Hollywood Usual Suspects and the world at large. In other words, an ongoing, massively multiplayer focus group.
Media has been held hostage to this notion that the only way or the best way you can possibly understand an audience is through its demographics.
Johanna Blakely is managing director of the Norman Lear Center at the Annenberg School.
There was this sense that you couldn't possibly understand what individual members of mass audiences were interested in, but if you knew a little bit about their age, if you knew their gender, if you knew how much money they made, where they lived, their race, you could make some assumptions about what their interests might be, and those interests might very well be associated with some purchasing behavior.
Hundreds of billions of dollars changed hands based on consumer behavior guesses pinned to little more than a zip code.
Nowadays, we're swimming in data, very detailed, granular data, about what people care about, what they're looking for, what they're saying online, what they're buying, what videos they're watching. This very rich data will tell you something much more nuanced about what individual members of very large audiences are interested in. And let me tell you, they don't live in the same zip code. It's going to be a kid in Bangladesh who has the same interests as a kid in Queens, who has the same interests as an old guy in North Dakota who went up there to start fracking.
Case in point, Netflix, which for a decade has been refining an algorithm to make detailed recommendations based on users' viewing patterns, post-viewing ratings, and self-reporting about tastes and interests. It is no exaggeration to say that Netflix knows what you will like better than you do.
House of Cards was a safe bet for them. They were willing to spend $100 million to get that production off the ground because they already knew there was a certain Venn diagram there that overlapped fans of David Fincher movies, fans of Kevin Spacey, and people who had seen the original BBC House of Cards. So they knew that there was an audience there.
When Orange is the New Black producer Jenji Kohan approached Netflix with her true-to-life dramedy, she'd already been repeatedly turned away by premium cable. But Netflix ran the numbers and realized, likable female lead, check. Prison story, check. Black comedy, check. Hot, hot thespian action, check.
I have a prison wife.
What?
Her name is Crazy Eyes.
Did she rape you?
No, she didn't rape me, but she held my hand.
I know that she pitched it to HBO and to Showtime, and they said, absolutely not. She went to Netflix, and they decided to do some research to see if there was actually an audience for it. And it turned out, oh my God, there is. Make it.
And the show is a hit, as long as you don't define hit by audience size or ad revenue. Netflix shows bring in zero ad revenue. What they do bring in is subscriptions to Netflix at $96 per year. In the fourth quarter of 2013 alone, the company signed on 2.3 million new subscribers. So yeah, Brave New World, Part 3. Alternate revenue models. In Netflix and Amazon's case, a very familiar one. What entertainment agent David Tochterman of Innovative Artists calls the cableization of the internet. Old movies and TV shows complemented with original programming.
HBO wasn't HBO until they started making original content. Same with Showtime, same with all these cable networks. House of Cards, I don't believe, would be able to be made if it was ad-supported.
In other quarters of the new streaming universe, ads have no place whatsoever. Technology enables performers to generate revenue directly from the consumer. No studio, no network, no aggregator, total disintermediation. An entirely new ecosystem.
I don't know if we fully appreciate the fact that we got out of the food chain. That is a massive upgrade. Because for every other living thing, life ends by being eaten. That's how all life ends, is every single life except human life. Every life ends like this. Ah! Ah! Ah!
Comedian Louis C.K. works in cable and does a robust business in live concerts, but he also streams comedy performances directly to viewers at $5 a pop. Nor is he alone in that sort of enterprise. Can we briefly go back to the Jimmy Kimmel special? A couple of minutes into Kevin Spacey's appearance, the two discussed the old Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Lo and behold, Kimmel said he'd appeared there 3 decades ago as a teenage magician.
Welcome, Amazing James. Can I call you Amazing?
No. Me, yes, Johnny Carson.
I see. Are you a little nervous, Amazing?
No.
Yeah. It was a gag featuring Spacey's uncanny Carson impression. But here's the thing. That clip wasn't on Sunday's broadcast. Kimmel's viewers had to go find it online at a URL provided by the TV host himself.
And, of course, on your website, kevinspacey.com,
yes,
you can see video of me on
right.
Johnny
That's
Carson show yeah. when I was Johnny a teenage Carson magician.
Right. Yeah.
Yes. What else is on that website?
What else is on the website? Aha. That would be the film Now. Spacey's documentary, which you can soon stream for $12.99 directly from kevinspacey.com. Now, advertising has by no means disappeared, even in the streaming economy. At Funny or Die, the business model resembles the Huffington Post. Big and not-so-big-name talent create videos gratis, getting their compensation psychically, while Funny or Die sells ad space against their content. CEO Dick Glover.
We will provide whatever support you want from a technical, from a writing, from a production point of view, whether you have something you want to promote, whether you have an idea that you've just really always cared about. What a great platform to do all that. So talent was very anxious to work with us.
Even though you actually never wrote them a check.
Never wrote them a check, correct.
Advertising also underwrites the rising stars of YouTube, among them the profane and perspicacious Kingsley, who covers rent and subsidizes college tuition on the strength of his more than 2.5 million channel subscribers and the ad revenue their eyeballs generate.
Kids be disrespecting their teachers, yelling at them, cursing at them, seeing news stories about like hitting them and spitting in their face, like, really? Are you that against learning about the damn nucleus and some mitochondria?
Yep, with a potty mouth, irresistible smile, and about $2,000 worth of consumer technology, this 23-year-old has double the audience of On the Media. Because YouTube is not just a video player, it's a community. And thus the final Brave New World element of modern video. Even when advertising underwrites the medium, it almost never advertises the medium. That is now the province of digital word of mouth. Digital entertainment agent David Tochterman.
What has changed is the development of a social media ecosystem that actually is capable of driving audience to another platform.
You know, like from TV to social media to the streaming platform. One last time, back to Jimmy Kimmel. Turns out, not even network TV is some isolated biosphere. It's part of the new ecosystem, too. Kimmel himself has nearly 4 million followers on his YouTube channel. And on Sunday night, he didn't just chat with Kevin Spacey and plug his website. Though they were live on camera, they nonetheless posed for a selfie, which, with reference to Ellen's record-breaking Oscar selfie, they tweeted out.
By the way, our selfie has already broken the record set earlier.
Yes. Oh, fantastic.
You know, they got 1 million in the first hour.
Yeah.
We got 2 million.
Wow.
That's right. So congratulations to us.
Yes, congratulations. While some in show business will be caked in dust from the rubble of broadcast TV's inevitable collapse, others will bathe, pristine and prosperous, in the stream. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurkhman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Mira Sharma, and Kimmy Regler. We had more help from Cameron Lindsay, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rick Kwan. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
I hope your weekends were fabulous, and I hope your Monday wasn't too ridiculous and whack. I'll see you on Wednesday. Thanks for watching. Bye.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.